I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. In the late 60s, when assassinations and race riots shook this country to the core, a couple of guys named Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen, one black, one white, decided that America was ready for an interracial comedy duo. They eventually had very successful careers separately, but while together, audiences didn't quite know what to make of them. Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen call themselves the first and the last black-white comedy team, and they've got a new book out chronicling their partnership called Tim and Tom, an American Comedy in Black and White. Tim and Tom joined me here at NPR News.
Good to see you, Tony.
Nice to meet you, Tony.
You know what? Let's start with this. Let's play a clip of you guys together back when you were doing your routine on the road, and let's talk about that, because I think that really sort of says who you are, what you were doing, and why you're here, and we're talking about it today. Here
1969.
It is. Check me out now. Remember, we brothers.
We brothers.
In the ghetto.
In the ghetto.
All right. Hey, what's happening, Jive? My main man. Say, look here, baby, this way I catch Big Mac. I got to ease uptown, get me some new rags. You know, a couple fronts, pair of gators. Go check them traps. Do a little night crawling through the hood.
That's out of sight, man. I didn't know you spoke a foreign language.
That's ghetto talk, man. That's the way you talk in the hood.
In the hood?
The neighborhood. Just walk up here and repeat what I just said. Come on now, I'm waiting for the bus. Hey, baby.
Look here, man. That's where I catch Big Rag. I gotta slide uptown and buy a bus. There's some alligators stuck in my traps. I'm gonna go crawl through the night with a hood on.
No, Tom. Don't you ever crawl through a black neighborhood with a hood on.
1969, a black comedian and a white comedian telling that joke on stage. I guess it would depend, Tim, where you told that joke in terms of how it was received.
Well, yeah, well, how hard they would laugh or whatever. But actually, the material worked in both black and white audiences, because you got to remember there was so much polarization at that time. Black audiences just loved to see him screw up their lifestyle, their style, and white folks just loved to see him take the dare and say things that they all, you know, would like to say.
How difficult, if at all, Tom, was it for you to find? Because this is race comedy, to find a place of comfort for you in the material that you did with something like this.
I had no discomfort whatsoever, mainly because I grew up in a predominantly black neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. But Tim and I were very comfortable, as Tim points out all the time, in our skin. We were buddies, we were pals, we were friends. And so what the audience was witnessing, they were looking in on a black guy and a white guy who were friends. We were having a discourse, regardless of what we were talking about, whatever, a lot of our material wasn't racial, but we were having a discourse, and they weren't.
Really?
They weren't. So they saw Tim and I having a lot of fun, you know, on stage.
What was it that made you and Tim decide to put this act together at that time?
Well, we were in the JCs at that time in a civic group, and we had written a drug education program teaching grade school children the ills of drug abuse with humor. We never thought we'd be in show, but this was the furthest thing from our minds. And the program became very successful in 50 states and in 22 foreign countries. JCs used that program as a model program through their publications. And one day, a little eighth grade girl said, "You guys are funny. You ought to become a comedy team." And the thought of a black-white comedy team intrigued us, because there never had been one in the history of America. So we went out and became the first, and as history shows, the last.
It's not often, Tim, that the Junior Chamber of Commerce is a place where entertainers get their start.
Yeah, yeah. Whenever people ask me how do you get in the show business, I said, "Join the JCs." They all go, "Ha ha!" I'm going, "No, I'm serious." Yeah, that's a wonderful thing about life. If you're just open for it, and you're not adverse to change or taking chances of. It can take you on a strange journey. And that young girl, she's now a grown woman, and we actually saw on our book tour in Chicago, she came up and introduced herself, and Tom remembered the family name.
Really?
She was a young lady. And, you know, interesting thing about it, as we think back from this point back, when she said that, the irony of it is she didn't say you ought to be a black and white comedy team. She just said, "You guys are funny. You ought to be a comedy team."
Wow.
You know, today she'd say you ought to be a black and white
comedy team. Now, when you, the book, Tim and Tom, An American Comedy in Black and White, you look back over what you did. You must be astounded, A, that you did it, B, that you, you know, had some relative success with it, and C, that, you know, nobody else was able to do that.
Yeah, that's the part that's really a bit surprising, is that there was, after that, not one successful team, and or two men who, or man, woman, however, that would have enough courage to go against the media vision of what black and white America is, to go against that and dare it, outside of sketches on Richard Pryor or Saturday Night Live or whatever it is, it was never done. And it was almost like a built-in taboo. That I find that interesting because we're so-called such a liberal nation after the civil rights era. You know, we're supposedly all that's behind us. We run into that now with the book. We have been, I've been a little bit frustrated that we have not gotten some of the interests of like the newspaper
morning talk shows.
No, not there? So much, but the newspaper critical reviews and book, whether they say good things or bad things, that the New York Times book review or the LA Times book review actually turned down the option to review the book because like, nobody's interested in that. You know, is that sort of so-called liberalism that actually worked against them just reviewing the book. Now, I'm not saying giving us a positive one.
I understand.
Just review the book.
That's why do you think they did that, Tom?
Well, I'm very frustrated. You know, when Tim and I were together, you know, we ran against this resistance all the time, a black guy and a white guy together. We ran against this resistance. We did two national television shows in those days. The David Frost Show, a black man, got us that show, and the Merv Griffin Show, a black woman, got us that show. Today, when we came back together, when we joined together again, just on this book tour, we did David Letterman. I called David personally. We did Jay Leno because Tim and I knew Jay Leno. We did that. We got through it personally. We did Tavis Smiley because Tim knew Tavis Smiley. We did Bonnie Hunt because of my relationship with Bonnie Hunt and Craig Ferguson because of the David Letterman show. The white liberal newspaper, as he pointed out, the LA Times would not review us, and neither would the white liberal newspaper, the New York Times, review us. So white liberals who claim to be liberal aren't really that liberal at all. Larry King Show turned us down, even though Barbara Sinatra called him personally. The View turned us down.
Even though we contacted
them personally, we knew people on it, The View. Regis and Kathy, Dave Letterman called them personally.
Actually, I turned Regis and Kathy down.
Okay. So, you know what I say? I say about if Tim would have written the book alone, it would have been a success, or if Tom Dreesen would have written the book alone. But Tim and Tom together, I say this to you. If Barack Obama would have been married to a white woman, he would have never gotten the nomination of his party. Never.
I'd have voted for him.
Yeah. If you read the book, you can find out why.
Let me tell our listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. With me are Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen talking about their new book, Tim and Tom, An American Comedy in Black and White. Were you really smacked in the face with a snowball in Minnesota on stage?
No, University of Illinois. A guy hit me right in the face with an ice ball. A guy put a lit cigarette out, as you know, you're going to probably get that. I put a lit cigarette out in Tim's face at a club in Chicago Heights, Illinois, and then tried to beat me half to death. But at University of Illinois, we were in the middle of our act, and a guy hit me right in the face with an ice ball. In the darkness, I couldn't see who it was, and it hit me so fast and so crisp, Tim didn't even realize it. My face was stinging, and I grabbed the mic, and I started calling him every name I could think of that I learned from the white and the black community, and I calling him out. Come on, turn the lights on, you coward. And Tim thought, half the audience thought it was part of a...
I thought he was having a seizure.
Half the audience thought it was part of our routine, and Tim thought that and the other half thought I was nuts, and Tim thought I went insane on the stage, too.
And Tim, and you had an even worse situation, huh?
Yeah, I mean, we were attacked. We were chased out of town. I was poisoned in the city. I mean, it was part of life that we understood was always possible back then. And in a sense that it was part of being black in America and was part of being a black and white comedy team in America. You know, I was raised in the segregated South in Colored Town. And so I knew going into it that there would be some resistance, but you forget that, and you just go do what you have to do. I mean, he was attacked on stage in New Orleans by a white bigot just because he said the guy's city was named after Calhoun, Amos and Andy's lawyer.
The guy said, I'm from Calhoun, Alabama. You know what that says? I said, yeah, that's Amos and Andy's lawyer, Calhoun.
Guy went berserk.
Well, you know, I would think, and I'm going to ask you, Tom, because since you were associated with Tim, who is black, just by extension, you became sort of a honorary black person for the time that you guys were together and were treated as one sometimes.
You want to know the interesting thing about racism in those days, and I can't speak for now, but it's probably the same now. In those days, if we were working in an all-black club, and we worked many all-black clubs, there were no comedy clubs in those days, so we worked the Chitlin' Circuit, you know, black-owned, black-operated nightclubs. If a black guy was in the audience and he hated white people, hated them with a passion, he wasn't mad at me. He was mad at Tim for being with me. If we worked a white club or the redneck who hated black people with a passion, he wasn't mad at Tim. He was mad at me for being with Tim, you know. So we always had that kind of, that's where racism was in those days. And we received it from both sides, but but on the other hand, 95% or more love what we did. All this in the last election, talking about we need more discourse among the races, you know, and Tim and I were the discourse in those days.
Everybody who was around, or not everyone, but many people who were around when you guys were doing your thing back in the 60s and 70s and so on further, at some point they get together again just to see, you know, what that would be like. You guys thinking about doing that again, even if it's just for a concert or, you know, putting the routine together one more time for old times' sake?
You're too old for that. But, no, I think we are, in a way, this book tour has done that, where we have talked and lectured and been doing shows. And it's sort of been interesting to not relive, but to be together and talk about that era in today's world. As Tom said, he has some frustrations about how some people in the business, so-called open liberalism in the business, has rejected us. It's not a surprise to me. I mean, it's part of life. It was a surprise to him. They didn't care then. They don't care now. But it is sort of interesting to see race today compared to what it was like then. As we now enter a new era of race, where literally Dr. King's prophecy has come to be that it's about the content of one's character.
This has been great. Let me bring it to a close with a couple of questions. Back in those days, there were what I would call four food groups of black comedy. Mm-hmm. Okay, first one was Richard Pryor. Second one was Bill Cosby. Third one was Dick Gregory. And the fourth one was Red Fox. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's my four food groups of comedy, black comedy. Where did your comedy fit into that?
We were sort of a blend of Dick Gregory and perhaps Bill Cosby. Now, you got to remember, Richard Pryor was not Richard Pryor back in the day.
That's true.
He was a late. That urban view of Richard didn't come until the 80s. Back then, he was an imitation, as we all were, of the great Bill Cosby, who to this day is probably the primo comedy genius. I know Richard gets the credit, but Richard, if I was alive today, would tell you it was Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
Red was by himself. But there were only two other comics doing race humor back then other than Tom and I, and that was Dick Gregory and Godfrey Cambridge, the late Godfrey Cambridge.
Yeah,
we're the only ones. No one else touched race.
It's true. Here's my question for you. It seems as if Johnny Carson really was a king maker for you. That story that you tell about your first appearance on Carson and how nervous you were when you finally, you know, went back and the stagehand was like, you know, you've arrived. Was it really that powerful?
Absolutely. In those days, wherever you went in America, people would say, what do you do for a living? You say, I'm a stand-up comedian. And the next question out of their mouth was, oh, yeah, you ever been on Johnny Carson? And if you hadn't been on Johnny Carson, in the eyes of America, you just weren't a comedian. You might want to be one. You might gonna be one. But you weren't one then because he established it. And so the pressure was enormous, absolutely enormous. You do one Tonight Show. Freddie Prinze did one Tonight Show. He got a sitcom the next day. I did one Tonight Show. The following day, CBS signed me to a development deal. I went from the unemployment line to having all my bills paid for a year. It was a very, very powerful show.
That's a great story on Johnny Carson and then being recognized in the unemployment line the next day.
The next day. And Tim, when you read the book, you'll find it was a pivotal point in my career, certainly, but a pivotal pivotal point. My first Tonight Show was a pivotal point in Tim's career, too, as he was laying up in bed watching me that night.
Broke. You know,
Is that when you were on the floor in the apartment with no furniture, no
that
woman?
That was right after that. I was...
Look where you are now.
The book is about motivation, it's about friendship, it's about bonding, it's about hardship. It's about all those things at a time, 1969 and 1975, when America was in turmoil, and Tim and I went across the land trying to just make people laugh. That's really all we wanted to do. And we accomplished that, and we're still here today. You know, and we're still making people laugh. In answer to his question, would we ever get back together? Maybe for one venture, maybe one time for a charity or something. But also, certainly I'd do something on television with Tim or, we do
you should do that,
a movie
man.
Together
you should
or something.
Do that.
Well, this is our 40th year in show business this year celebrated. So we were thinking about, we got to do something. 40 years.
Absolutely.
My God, survive that long in this business.
You've done a lot of things, but I would bet, Tim, that people still associate you mostly with Venus Flytrap.
Yeah. I knew that when I went audition for the job. I said, I don't think I want this job. I don't want to be 60 years old and have somebody say, hey, Venus. And boy, it happens.
The same thing happened to me in respect. I did over 500 appearances on national television as a stand-up comedian, 61 appearances on The Tonight Show. I've hosted David Letterman's show. But everybody always says, didn't you travel with Frank Sinatra? Weren't you Frank Sinatra's opening act? I know I told Frank one day that one day, no matter what I do in life, I could find the cure to cancer, my obituary is going to say the comedian who toured with Frank Sinatra, because he was larger than life. You know?
Amazing, guys. Thank you for coming in and sharing your story. It's great. I really appreciate it. Good luck with this.
Thank you.
Thank
I'll call
you,
some of my friends for you.
Oh, please do. Please do.
By the way,
money.
Tony, yours, $24.95 that you have in your hand.
That was Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen. They've got a new book out about their years as a stand-up comedy duo called Tim and Tom, an American comedy in black and white. They joined us here at the studios of NPR West. If you'd like to see video of our interview, go to our blog at nprnewsandviews.org.
Not all of the epic stories in American history are well known. Consider the lives of the first African-American members of Congress. They served during the Reconstruction era just after the Civil War. Historian Philip Dre tells their stories in a new book, Capital Men. NPR's Tony Cox got the chance to talk to him about his work.
Philip, welcome to News and Notes. It's nice to have you on.
Thanks, Tony.
Let's start with this. Congressman George White from North Carolina ended his term in office in 1901. He was the first to introduce an anti-lynching law, and it got him run out of office. I want to start there because the end of his term marked the end of an era, didn't it?
Yes, absolutely. It's an era that began shortly after the Civil War when Congress, in order to allow the former Confederate states back into the Union, insisted that they hold constitutional conventions, which would make it possible for black men to vote. And so that caused a kind of electoral revolution in the South. You suddenly had blacks not only voting, something that they were very enthusiastic about, but also electing black officials for the first time. So you had the beginning of a series of about 20 black congressmen who came to Washington from the South and served through the end of Reconstruction in the late 1870s, and then, as you mentioned, all the way up to George White, the very end of the century.
Now, you write about the first seven black members of Congress. What did they have in common beside their race? For example, they weren't all former slaves, were they?
The one thing that I think they had in common was that they all were very exceptional people. Some of them had been slaves. Some had been free blacks. What they had in common was a kind of a, sort of ambition to lead and to serve.
Of these early black politicians, who stands out for you and why?
Well, there's several. There's a man named Robert Brown Elliott, who was a congressman from South Carolina. He was a little bit like Barack Obama in a way, in that he was his origins were a little mysterious. He was extremely eloquent and wrote beautiful speeches, and in fact gave a speech on the floor of Congress in 1874, where he was confronting the former vice president of the Confederacy in Congress and sort of won the day. And his speech was lauded all over the country, and they even made a beautiful lithograph of it, and he was kind of the toast of the town. And so he was an interesting character. Another one I could mention is Robert Smalls, who they called him the boat thief. He, as a slave, he was working on a Confederate boat, and he managed to steal it and deliver it to the Union Navy, for which he became kind of a hero in the North, and then sort of capitalized on that to become a politician after the war. And he was served a very long time from the Sea Islands district of South Carolina, and was just hated by the whites of the South. They always called him the boat thief for the rest of his life into the 20th century.
Your book, notwithstanding, history has not been kind, I don't think, to the first black congressmen, many of them being depicted as corrupt or buffoons. We know that that is an inaccurate stereotype, but is there any truth behind that representation at all?
Well, not really. In other words, you have to remember that, of course, the South was very resistant to the idea of Reconstruction, and the black elected officials were, in a certain way, the worst insult to them. The idea that their former chattel would become, come to occupy positions of authority was very insulting to them. And, of course, the press caricatured the black legislators mercilessly. The truth, of course, was different, which was what bothered the whites in the South about the black politicians was not their ignorance, but rather their intelligence, because the blacks took very well, actually, to being politicians. They were fairly adept at it. They came to understand the legislative process and were really quite effective.
Well, to follow that point, how effective was the Reconstruction period, and why was it called the Glorious Failure?
Well, that's in a way a very good term, because it was very idealistic at first, and it was sort of glorious. It was based on a lot of very sort of nice democratic instincts about these new citizens. There were 4 million new citizens after the Civil War, making them equal, making them citizens, giving them the right to vote. There was an effort that the black congressmen were involved in to actually make it so that blacks would enjoy equality in what's called, public accommodations. In other words, riding on a train, seeing a play in a theater, eating in a restaurant. That did not succeed. That was sort of their thrust generally, was to kind of try to use the time they had to broaden the equality and the opportunities, really, for black Americans.
Now, black congressmen presented the case against the Ku Klux Klan. How did they do it, and what impact did it have?
I think it had a lot of impact because one thing the black congressman could do better than any white, however sympathetic, was that the blacks could really speak truth to power. In other words, when they came from, say, South Carolina or North Carolina to Washington to testify in Congress or to speak in Congress, they could say, just 3 days ago, I was stopped on the road by the Klan and they threatened to kill me. And I'm here now by the grace of God. And please, let's pass this Ku Klux Klan Act so we can get some federal help down there. So they really kind of, could testify, could sort of bear witness in a way that no one else could.
You make comparisons in the book between what happened during Reconstruction with the results of the 2000 and 2004 presidential elections a century and a half later. What are they?
After the sort of like over-the-top violence of the Klan seemed to fail, the South turned to a great degree to kind of like ballot box trickery and phrasing of voting laws that were meant to not openly defy the Constitution of the United States, because that would be too much, but rather to make it virtually impossible for black people to vote. There were all kinds of strange tricks like, marking the ballot boxes differently to confuse illiterate voters. There was something called the Understanding Clause, where a registrar could ask an applicant to explain or to understand any paragraph from the state constitution, which, of course, then left it up to the registrar to have total latitude about, oh, well, that answer's not right. So like white illiterates or any white voter could be passed, but any black could be turned away. And, of course, these kind of tricks, we see them again. They're happening. Even right now, there's something going on out in Ohio where the Republican Party is being kind of crafty about finding ways to basically make it sort of imposing on people to try and come and vote. And so we still see these kind of things going on. They're maybe more sophisticated now, but it's basically the same idea.
Congressman George White from North Carolina ended his term, as we said, in 1901. There was not another congressman, at least from the South, as I understand it, until when, 1970?
It was 1973 when Barbara Jordan and Andrew Young were elected. So, it's funny because George White, he's a wonderful character, and I loved including him in the book. he was the first person to advocate an federal anti-lynching law. And for his trouble, he got attacked by his home state, the white press in North Carolina, went after him viciously. And he fought back. He sort of exposed the kind of sexual double standard of, you know, you're complaining, you're making up all these things about sexual assaults on white women. Let's start talking about the actual consensual relations between white women and black men, and also the access that white men seem to want to enjoy with black women, and so on and so on. And this, of course, at that, you know, in the 1890s, this was like beyond insulting. And the campaign to get him out of Congress was intense, so much so that the day he left, the state of North Carolina declared a day of Thanksgiving. And White, of course, had a great sense of self-drama. And on his last day in Congress, he stood up and gave this speech that he called the Negro's Farewell, basically saying, you know, we've enjoyed being here, we've done what we could, and we'd love to stay, but, you know, we'll be back. And this was in 1901. And, of course, it took 72 years for another Southern congressman to set foot on the floor of Congress.
Philip, thank you very much. You did a good job on the book. I appreciate you sharing your time with us.
Thanks a lot, Tony.
That was NPR's Tony Cox talking with historian Philip Dre. He's the author of Capital Men, the epic story of Reconstruction through the lives of the first black congressmen. Dre joined us from our NPR studios in New York.
Of our weary years, God of our silent tears, thou who has brought us thus far on our way.
There is a sense of national pride among African Americans like never before with today's inauguration. A song written in 1899 that celebrates that pride is Lift Every Voice and Sing, known originally as the Negro National Anthem. You're hearing Kim Weston singing it in the background. She sang it for the inauguration of the outgoing president, George W. Bush, in 2001, and she was the first major pop star to ever record the song. It wasn't sung today, but is often heard at major black cultural events.
When we say no more yes about, what time is
That's
it?
Jesse Jackson at the 1972 Black Cultural Megafest known as Wattstacks.
Mr. Kim Weston, the Black National Anthem.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring, ring with a hope.
So, Kim, here you are, singing live at the L.A. Coliseum, 1972, stadium full of afros and fists in the air.
Oh, yes. I'm glad you mentioned that. Yes, yes. I was told that I was blackballed because when the record company saw those fists go up, they thought it was a militant thing, you know. But it was nation time, and that really was the first time that I'd seen anything like that. And it just overwhelmed me. It really did. It was a wonderful occasion at Wattstacks.
Had you ever sung that song before that kind, that size of an audience?
Oh, no, no. There were over 100,000 people there at that particular day.
That song, of course, was written in 1900 by James Weldon Johnson in honor of Abraham Lincoln. How did it happen that you came to record that song in 1968?
Listen, I learned Lift Every Voice and Sing here in Detroit at Brownson Elementary School in kindergarten, and I'm 102 now. You know,
so. Come on. Well, you know what? Let's talk about Motown a little bit, because you mentioned Detroit, and your career obviously got a big boost during the time that you were at Motown. But at the time that you were about to leave Motown, you left there on, well, I don't know if you call it a high note or not, but you had a pretty big hit, you and Marvin Gaye together.
Well, you know what? Actually, Marvin and I had recorded that song 2 years. We recorded an upper two albums over 2 years prior to that. And that was one of the reasons that I left, because I didn't feel that I was being treated fairly. You know, of course, Motown played, they made me national or international. I learned an awful lot while at Motown, and they played a very important part in my career.
Do you feel like you made the wrong decision by leaving?
I do not regret leaving, because if you remember in the 60s, the life of a record was about 3 months. And if you had a hit, usually they would release your next single before that one died down. So as soon as they stopped playing the hit, they had the new record. Well, I never got a release. I got a release every 6 to 9 months, whether I had a hit record or not. And I didn't think that was fair.
It takes two, baby.
It Takes Two, was that your biggest hit?
That was my biggest hit with Marvin. My biggest single by myself was Take Me in Your Arms. And I never had an album while I was at Motown. It created a big void for me.
You went to England and became, or you became a star in England, I should say. And I know that you signed with MGM Records. You've been quoted as saying that you finally felt free to sing the songs that you wanted to sing after you left Motown. Was Lift Every Voice one of those songs?
Lift Every Voice was one of the songs. And going back to your original question, how did I come about singing that? I sung at a Lakers Knickerbocker championship game. I did the Star Spangled Banner. And the switchboard lit up, I guess, like it did when Marvin did it. And so when they asked me about recording the Star Spangled Banner, I said the only anthem I was interested in recording was Lift Every Voice. So that's how that came about.
So you are political.
You think so?
Sounds like it. Just a little.
Well, you know, I've done a lot of things. I've worked close with Reverend Jackson for a good while. And the church that I was raised in, you know, there's politics in everything, Tony. You know,
mm-hmm.
Life. If you got rules and regulations, there's politics.
You're right.
You know what I'm saying? I don't care where it is. So, my thing was that I felt that I needed to do what I could to help my people. Not saying that I wouldn't help anybody and everybody, but I was asked once by Miriam Makeba, which of course was an honor, to come to Africa and help. And she was saying that because of Lift Every Voice. And I said, but Miriam, I said, my people here in America, and this was before the Voting Act, the Voting Rights Act was passed. I said, my people here are suffering, maybe not like your people, but considering where I came from, I feel that we were going through some similar struggles, you know?
Now, let me ask you this, because you've already talked, and it's really interesting and fascinating to hear about singing at the Laker game. I think I saw that, by the way. I think I did. And we know that you did it at Watt Stacks, but you sang Lift Every Voice on an occasion that when I heard about it, it struck
your
me
mouth
as
blew open.
Yeah, you know it did. The inauguration of President Bush in 2001. That seems like an odd pairing, was it?
When the invitation came, I thought somebody was playing with me, but my friend that called me to tell me that I had an invitation to sing for President Bush told me that the Bush campaign was trying to find a way to bridge that void between the black community and the Republican Party, and they asked, would I sing Lift Every Voice at the inauguration? Well, I'd never been invited to sing for a president before, so I didn't care what party he was with. I said yes.
Okay. So it wasn't an issue whether you were a supporter or not a supporter of George Bush.
Absolutely not. And anybody that asked me, I told them, I said, well, listen, he's still my president. I don't care if he is a Republican.
He is.
So, and the fact that he requested me to sing that, I considered that an honor, you know. And I haven't said this on an interview anywhere, but I'm doing my autobiography. I do have that in there. In his finale line, I'm the only person that he kissed. So I was kind of impressed with him in the very beginning. I got a little upset with him, but a little afterwards, you know.
Did you take a picture with him?
Yes, I took a picture with him.
Yeah, is there a story about that picture?
Well, there is one, but I'm saving it for my book, Tony.
Kim Weston, let me ask you this. As a song, how would you characterize Lift Every Voice and Sing?
As a song, Lift Every Voice and Sing is one of the hardest songs there is to sing. It's equipped. Well, you know what? Actually, I heard that it was submitted to be the national anthem for the country. But the Star Spangled Banner won, you know. But it's not blues, it's not gospel, but it's almost classical. I've always loved the song because it has a special meaning for me because when I started out, I said I was raised in a section of Detroit called Black Bottom. But in Black Bottom, though, we used it as a community, and we had a lot of pride. And the fact that I learned this song in kindergarten, I think, shows that.
Won't you sing it with me, everybody? Sing a song.
That was singer Kim Weston. She's the first major pop star to record Lift Every Voice and Sing, a song known today as the Black National Anthem. Weston was not asked to sing the song at today's inauguration, but she wants President Obama to know, for the future, he only needs to say the word, and she'll be there, tuned up and ready to go.